I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. Thought we'd visit our friends in the Mediterranean and like that. The so-called Arab Spring has been in place for about 2 years now, and thought it was time to take a look at it again, especially since some things have happened recently. There was an election in Egypt, Jim. What were the results of that?
Well, the new boss is the same as the old boss. You know, what I call the describe the Arab Spring as being is a triumph of hope over experience. The Arab world has a lot of cultural baggage, and you can change the book jacket, as it were, very quickly, but you can't change the book that quickly. There are cultural, economic, religious, those are the three big ones, factors, which do not get changed quickly. And no one's really been able to do it. In Egypt, for example, the primary element in the society is the ancient oligarchy. In other words, for thousands of years, you know, the pharaohs depended upon the wealthy families, the Romans depended upon the wealthy families. When, you know, Farouk was overthrown and the generals took over, they depended upon the wealthy families. And when the 2011 revolution and overthrow of Mubarak came along, sure, Mubarak was gone, but he was a figurehead. The families were still there. We pointed this out, Strategy Page. And, of course, one of the biggest family institutions was the military, which is staffed primarily by, the sons, as it were, of the most prominent, the wealthiest, most powerful families. And, of course, now we have another general in charge, and he's there for one primary, function, to take care of the families. Now, he knows that if he doesn't do something for the rest of the Egyptians, the 99%, as it were, there'll be more unrest, which has been a problem in Egypt, again, for thousands of years. Pharaoh did have some basic duties, like keeping people fed and reasonably, well off. And when he failed in that, there was a new dynasty coming along. Basically said, yeah, we'll do it better this time, but it was the same old story. In Syria, the Syrians, for thousands of years, we're not talking about something new. We're talking about something that's very ancient, very persistent. Syria was always the wheeler dealers. And they basically, the most recent version of that, the Hassad dynasty, they basically used Islamic terrorism to keep a minority government in power. Tunisia was very much the same thing, except it's a much smaller country. As Austin pointed out, it's as if Carthage, which is now Tunisia, Carthage never went away. And indeed it did. A lot of North African nations are ancient, kingdoms and regions. And they really maintain their character, more than I think even the locals would like. And Tunisia always had a way of, working things out, which is what they have done better than anybody else. Libya was always an artificial country. It was a bunch of, tribal kingdoms, as it were, mashed together by the colonial power. And then when Italy, all the colonial powers left, they left this artificial entity in place, which Gaddafi tried to maintain, but he couldn't. And now it's coming apart into its tribal components. Now, what Libya is trying to do, they recognize that the old ways are not necessarily the best. They are trying to get some sort of grand agreement, as it were, amongst all the major groups to say, look, do we want to be Libya? Or do we want to be all these little entities squabbling with each other? Because now they can fight over the oil. And that's what they're really confronting. And that's what the more statesmanlike Libyans are trying to get everybody to understand and come to some sort of compromise. So the Arab Spring wasn't a total waste. But what it did do was focus on the underlying problems and make people realize that, you know, simply changing the guy in charge is not going to fix all those underlying, you know, difficulties that have to be confronted and really dealt with.
The faces changes, but things remain the same.
Yeah, same. The old boss is the same as the new boss. You know, like the song.
Boston.
I'm gonna come in with a little different perspective on it. Let me take it from Tunisia. I'm glad, Dan, that you started out with calling it the Mediterranean or the Mediterranean littoral. Remember, there were other quote unquote Arab Spring disruptions in 2011, including Yemen, Bahrain, but the big four, the four that we think of as Arab Spring, they're all Mediterranean nations. And guess what? They were all Roman provinces at one time as well. They were part of the big the Roman Empire and the Great Roman Lake. Let's take it from Tunisia. Jim and I have both gone extensively discussed Tunisia, and Tunisia is a slow success in my view. Interesting that Jim brought up Carthage. Yeah, you've got a trading system, wealthy families, oligarchy, and also a central Mediterranean position, but also a looking north orientation. Excuse me, not just because it was a French protectorate, but heavens, it's a great place to have a seaport on the Mediterranean, and that internationalizes your outlook. What's happened in Tunisia? Tunisia has gotten a lot of, let's put it, what's the best way to put it? It hadn't gotten the economic support that it wants. Jim would call it the economic bribes, I think, to support the system. But it has gotten a lot of political support, particularly from the French, saying that you're going to telling the Islamists, the Ennahda party, and it is a moderate Islamist party for the, a vast percentage of the Ennahdists were said that we are committed to having a secular constitution. They got, when Ennahda won the election and was in power, the senior members of the Ennahda party were regularly seen with members of the secular opposition. They went out of their way to say, we're going to have a broad-based coalition. We may be in power, but we're going to listen to our opposition. And there were regularly pictures of the French government ministers and many of their senior French government bureaucrats in Tunis, talking with the Ennahda party and the Tunisian government, talking about how you need to proceed so that you don't end up looking like your neighbors, Libya, don't have the problems going on in Egypt, and heaven forbid the problems going on in Syria. So the Tunisians were looking at the other three possibilities, and heavens, there's a Ansar al-Sharia group. That's the group, one of their militias is the one that attacked the American consulate in Benghazi, but they have an affiliate, which is an al-Qaeda affiliate inside Tunisia, launching attacks. But the Tunisian military, which also acted as a largely neutral force during the Tunisian Arab Spring, to its credit, people give their give the Tunisian military extensive credit, and they should, turned in and said, our fight is to get rid of these guys. And we covered that on strategy page too, because there were some ugly incidents up in the mountain range. That said, when it came to the crunch time, Dan, the constitution is secular. Yes, Tunisia has a Islamic identity, but you don't have to be a Muslim or you don't have to believe anything to be a citizen of Tunisia. Now, to get back to Jim's point, it takes a long time to change the book, and you can just change the cover. Well, the Tunisians are attempting from it a more pluralistic and more internationally oriented culture there in Tunis. And as Jim said, if you don't think it isn't, just think about Carthage. Carthage is just, what, 25 or 30 kilometers, I'm talking about the ruins, north of Tunis anyway. It's really the same place. That's their cultural, that's a component of their culture, Dan. And I see them as something of a success. Let's go to Egypt. Jim says, well, the oligarchy's back, and they just back to, you know, who's ever's backing the latest dictator or politician. Well, I guess the oligarchy, you could say, goes back to supporting Pharaoh. But the Egyptians do have a real national identity. They've got a national identity in trump cards, at least 5,000 years of history, of recorded history, 5,500, according to some Egyptologists. This is one of the things that Mohamed Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood never appreciated because it conflicted with their ideology, which is Islamist internationalism. And that was, why are these 60 various groups, Muslim groups from all over the world, collecting in Cairo, and why does the president of Egypt spend his time hobnobbing with them? That was a common question even before Morsi became despised by 80% of the Egyptian people. Why don't you, Mr. Morsi, Mr. President, focus on our Egyptian problems, our economy, and the changes? That's because he's Muslim Brotherhood. We're internationalists. We're out to establish the caliphate. That's one of the things that why al-Sisi, when he was General al-Sisi, he's now President al-Sisi, but General al-Sisi was such a popular coup. And overwhelmingly a popular coup. I think it's going to be very, very difficult for al-Sisi to solve Egypt's embedded economic problems, because a lot of the embedded problems go back to the oligarchy, and the senior poor elements of the military are in business. It's going to be difficult to change. That said, it is a reasonable bet that the Egyptian experiment with the Muslim Brotherhood in power is done, and that the Egyptian people are going to support a government military battle with Muslim Brotherhood extremists, and that's a replay of what was going on in 1980. And that's something we've written about on Strategy Page. Actually, Jim and I wrote about in early editions of The Quick and Dirty Guide to War. So let's move to Libya. That's number three. You know, Libya's a coastline with tribes in the outback. We've seen the chaos. Jim, I think some of Jim's coverage on Libya has just really been outstanding. When I was on, InstaVision, Glenn Reynolds' video cast for Pajamas Media a couple of times, and brought up our Libya coverage. Great description, deep description of the tribal demands. Everybody wants a share of the oil. That was part of one of the gripes about Gaddafi. Besides Gaddafi being insane, it was, you know, he only favored tribes. Well, they're trying to work out a deal. Also, the legitimate Libyan nationalist groups that are opposing the Islamist militias. We've seen the rise of, I'm going to get his name wrong, Jim, General Haftar. Is that his name? I believe that's
close enough.
Close on this. Up in the air, I'm still, I may be the only one on the planet, something of a Libyan optimist, because Libya's got a product, oil. It's got an infrastructure to deliver it. At least a physical infrastructure. It needs a political infrastructure, and I believe that's eventually going to emerge, in part because it's got Egypt on one flank and Tunisia on the other flank. And there's what Libya needs more than anything else is international oversight, and that is going to mean NATO, and that's going to mean Western leadership, and we don't see that. And I'll just leave that as a segue into Syria, where, Syria was Arab Spring that truly internationalized. And who internationalized it? Iran, also Russia, because they were going to do anything to save the Assads. The Assads were Iran's footprint on the Mediterranean. Their forward political operational mechanism for supplying Hezbollah, Lebanese Hezbollah, which is their tip of the spear to point at Israel. It gave them a great base. You're also seeing what happens when a pizza pie, an ethnic and religious pizza pie, which is what Syria is, just like in, I mean, Syria is a big Lebanon. Well, it's all the Levant, and that's also why some Syrians still make claims on Lebanon, saying it's part of greater Syria. Well, you've got all these multiple sectarian, multiple confessional groups, various types of Christians, various types of Muslims, even several heretical groups. The Druze don't want to be called heretical, but Muslims call them heretics. And what united the rebels was hatred for the Assads, which, you know, we'll talk about it running a corrupt oligarchy. That's the way the Assads operated it, based around their own Alawite religious/ethnic group. And as we've discussed in prior podcasts, the Alawites are regarded by many Muslims. They say they're off as Shias, but the question of whether what they practice is in Islam, highly syncretic Islam, if it is. But you have the Iranians internationalizing it, and the Russians, and then a NATO response, because having Syria is on a NATO border, Turkey. And Turkey was the lead NATO nation in the response, as it should be, but the Turks never wanted to make a full commitment without knowing that they were going to get support from the rest of NATO, and the key NATO player on this was the United States. Where are we going to go? And without going into all the deep politics of it, I'll just use one as an example. When a red line was given by the American president on the use of chemical weapons, it was not enforced. And you weapons pour in, as Jim has written, from a lot of different sources going to a lot of groups that are tough to control. If we want to talk about the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, ISIS, ISIL, same group, or al-Shams, which is Syria. I saw in a report this morning about the ISIL takeover in Mosul. The report was calling it the Islamic State of Iraq and al-Shams, which is fine. That means Syria or the Levant. They got weapons. They got weapons from somewhere. Perhaps it came from the Persian Gulf. But they used their operations in eastern Syria as a base for turning back onto western Iraq. Who knows what the resources were, and where they came from. There are claims that some of the early ISIL weapons actually came from the Turks. Who knows? The situation in Iraq is spreading from what the chaos in Syria. And so this is I say that Syria is a huge problem. It is to classify it now as an Arab Spring problem Arab Spring revolution, I think, minimizes the extent of the internationalization and the general failure of effective Western NATO response to the problem of Syria.
Jim, just returning to Libya, are they going to end up in a civil war there?
Well, they've been in a state of civil war since shortly after Gaddafi was overthrown. The first mistake they made was, wasn't really a mistake. They tried. They didn't have the newly elected national, assembly. I wouldn't really call it a government. Didn't have what it took to disarm the hundreds of private militias that composed the rebel force. And a lot of those militias were based upon tribal organization, so they were pretty tight. A lot of them were just gangsters. A large number of them were Islamic terrorist groups who had come in, a lot of foreigners, but some locals. And they became stronger and stronger because they were better organized. They had a focus, which obviously the tribal and gangster groups did not have. And so the country has never coalesced. The problem we have throughout the Arab Spring was the continuing inability of most Muslim cultures to deal with Islamic radicalism or Islamic terrorism, as it quickly becomes. This has been a problem in the Muslim world for over 1,000 years. In other words, there was a struggle for leadership, you know, in the few generations after the original Prophet Muhammad died, that turned into a civil war that is still going on. The Shia and the Sunni were one of the earliest manifestations of this. The Shia wanted one line of succession, the Sunni wanted another. They're still arguing over this. But there are many other disagreements. In the last century, there was a return to fundamentalism as this occurred after Turkey was removed as the colonial, centuries-long colonial master of the Arab countries. The Europeans stuck around for a decade or so and then left. And what remained were basically countries, you know, that didn't really exist in reality. I mean, they were basically people, old Turkish colonial era, you know, aristocrats or, you know, westernized, you know, bureaucrats who became presidents and what have you, or what was often the case, you know, military officers who, the traditional strongman who has always been, you know, the fellow most likely to run the kingdom of the country in that part of the world. And this goes back thousands of years. They never really figured out how to deal with governing themselves. I mean, the Arab world especially is a mess, culturally, economically, socially, you name it. And of course, until quite recently, when you got the Arab reform movement going, which was created by Arabs, for Arabs, and even sponsored by countries like Saudi Arabia, who see the senior people say, hey, you know, there's got to be some fundamental reforms made before we can move forward. The Arabs dismissed the idea that there was anything wrong. Many still do. Say, oh, no, it's all the West, it's all foreigners, or it's all heretics, which means anybody who doesn't agree with them. And these problems are still there. And until they are solved, there's not going to be any peace. I mean, it's as simple as that. There's no black magic involved here. You just look at the history of the Islamic world, and you'll see the same problems recurring every four or five or fewer generations. Terrorism, civil war, everybody gets exhausted. There's a phony peace for a generation or two or more, depending on how powerful a dictatorship the strongman can set up in one area or another. Which is why most of the Arab countries have for over 1,000 years been part of somebody else's empire. You know, when you cannot get organized and take care of yourselves, somebody else, a more powerful neighbor, will come in and do it for you. And this is something the Arabs have never acknowledged and never gotten away from. In other words, when the Western colonial powers simply took over from the Turks as a caretaker, as it were, when they realized what they had their hands on, they really, you know, ran for the door, as it were. And the Arabs, you know, without the oil, they'd probably be less dangerous because there'd be less money available to buy explosives and, you know, support, you know, terrorists and what have you. But without the oil, it'd be an even bigger mess. Of course, the oil is running out. And a few of the Arab countries, you know, especially in the Persian Gulf, they realized that, you know, they've done the math, and they say, oh my God, you know, we got to do something, and they're trying, but it's difficult because they're dragging all this historical baggage along with them. you know, the as progressive as some Saudis appear, and they are, they are the chief incubators of the Islamic radicalism, because their local form of Islam is very conservative. And the great compromise the Saudi kings made, you know, over 50 years ago, was that, you know, we'll give you conservatives a lot of power in the country to control how people live, how they're educated, and in return you keep the peace. And that has basically been followed. You know, all the clergy are on the king's payroll. But, you know, it didn't work out the way they expected, because basically the wealthy Saudis exported the radical ideas. That's why it showed up in Pakistan. It's why it's showing up everywhere, because a lot of that money for, again, the religious conservatives in Saudi Arabia get billions of dollars for basically missionary work. And they go to everywhere, the West as well as other Muslim countries, and establish mosques. You know, there were some in New York City. They establish religious schools. And these schools teach a very conservative version of Islam, which has a very bad attitude towards non-Muslims. Now, for a long time, for decades, most Westerners weren't aware of this. And now, of course, a lot of it's being translated, what's being said, not just, you know, in the books that are passed out to the students, but, you know, the sermons in mosques in Western countries, as well as in many, you know, Muslim countries. So the Saudis tried to have it both ways and it didn't work. And they're sort of beside themselves, because they've created this Frankenstein monster and they can't control it. And the best they can come up with is, well, if we educate people and give them, you know, take care of their economic needs, you know, it'll all turn out. Well, yes and no. But what they have done is created some very well-educated terrorists. A bunch of them, you know, flew into the World Trade Center, you know, in 2001. And that's still going on. The money is still coming out of Saudi Arabia, the Persian Gulf in general, where you have basically very religious and very wealthy people quietly, even though it's illegal now, you know, getting the money out to Islamic terrorist groups all over the world, but especially in the Muslim world. And until those problems are addressed and fixed, the problem's going to keep on happening.
Like, I had this weird thought flip into my mind while you were talking about Saudi Arabia and they're exporting Wahhabism and like that. Is that Wahhabism is Saudi Arabia's common core. So anyway,
Dan,
which they've been fighting against, that the Saud dynasty was founded by Abdulaziz back in the 1920s, and from the very beginning he had to very carefully deal with the Wahhabites, because they helped them get into power. But he understood, this is the genius of the guy and the reason why his family is still running the show. He understood that can't live without them, can't get rid of them, but somehow we have to cope. And they're still struggling with that. I mean, it's an impossible situation. I think the Saudis have handled it better than anybody could have expected, or anybody else for that matter, but they still haven't solved it.
Right.
Dan, I want to pick up on that point that Jim made real quick. 2002, when I was in Southeast Asia, and ultimately I did an article on the terror threat to Singapore and the Straits. I talked with numerous Indonesian Malay Muslims, and they would talk about, and this is the way it was put to me by several extremely well-educated Malays in particular, the Arab Islam, and what they meant was Wahhabism. And they said that we'd been watching the process that Jim just described for 2 to 3 decades of kindergartens being established that were essentially promoting the, when Jim is calling it ultra conservative Islam, the Muslims that I met with would say, hey, I'm a Muslim conservative. I'm just not a Wahhab telling everybody how they're supposed to live with this, what they would call an Arab tribal structure. And it was very interesting theological discussion, but also, as they point out, it has real political effects. And we've been facing these political effects for 3 decades, and you Americans just woke up if we did wake up a year earlier, meaning in 2001 on 9/11. So it is the rest of the world was way ahead of the U.S. on the point that Jim was making. Jim, I got a question for you, and I think this would lead to a wind up, if not another program. But let's talk about northern Iraq right now and the spillover by the Islamic State of Iraq and al-Shams and going into Mosul. Where do you think the support for, we'll just call it ISIL right now, came from? And now what does the Iraqi central government and its allies, such as they are, do about Mosul? And I understand that Tikrit's fallen as well.
Well, what's apparently in the process of happening is the Shia Iraqis have done the only thing they could do. They called in the Kurds. The Kurds have the only effective army in Iraq, you know, the Peshmerga, trained, disciplined, reliable, and they love to kill Arabs. They are basic now. How much they've been given by the Shia government is hard to tell. What the Kurds want is Mosul and Kirkuk and all the oil they are in. I don't know if the Shias are going to give that up voluntarily, but it looks like they don't have much choice because the problem with the Shia, they're the majority. You know, there are 60% of the population, Kurds are the other 20%. But they're so busy stealing from one another that nobody's minding the arm of the security forces. You know, the police and the army are very corrupt. Again, the corruption is not just epidemic, but colossal. Well, and again, cultural baggage, it always has been. Even the Romans and the ancient Persians complained about how corrupt the Baghdadis were. They could be effective, but they were extremely corrupt. Everything was for sale. And it's still a problem. And the Kurds see an opportunity. I think in the next week, you're going to see Turkey, who are basically, Turks are very clever. They have their problems with the Kurds, but you know they realize that the Kurds can be an asset at times. And this may be one of them. I mean, the Turks have always wanted their Mosul province back. They've never made a big deal about it. Mosul, northern Iraq, used to be part of the Turkish homeland, not a conquered province. And the Allies, after World War I, they took it away from Turkey because oil had already been discovered. They didn't want the Turks to have oil in case they wanted to reestablish their empire. If the Turks did, that oil would have been very useful. Now, nobody foresaw, you know, Kemal Atatürk and this enormous, you know, reform that he enacted, which I think he would have done with without the Mosul oil. But the problem is the only thing in Iraq that can keep Iraq together are the Kurds. How ironic is that? You know, the Shia may or may not get it together. I imagine already some Kurdish Iraqi diplomats are talking to the United States about, gee, you've got some troops and air power in the Persian Gulf and Kuwait. Maybe you could help us out. Now, hopefully, our guy, Kerry, whatever, is going to say, let's have a status of forces document signed first. And, okay, if you can do that in 24 hours, you know, in 25 hours, we can help you. It's going to be very interesting the next week.
Well, I want to add a couple of things on this. I started on an essay on this, and it may be my column next week, Dan, I believe it is that the irony of the Kurds being an asset to the Turks, and yet we've followed the last 3 or 4 years of what the Turkish government, and this is one of Erdogan's, a positive in general on Erdogan's part, and everybody knows I'm a big critic of Erdogan for a lot of reasons, but it was to try to find a political compromise with Turkish Kurds. Well, here's a strange opportunity to. And by the way, part of that compromise was an outreach from the Turkish government to the Kurdistan Regional Government, which is the Kurdish government controlling the what it still amounts to the Kurdish autonomous zone inside Iraq. The ISIL, Dan, is a problem for every responsible group in the area, and that's what Jim is talking about. I think one of the Kurds being brought in both by the Iraqi central government and maybe being helped helped by the Turks as well. I think a U.S. support is it's something that we owe Iraq. In terms of airstrikes, intelligence, and as Jim said, you know, we do have some troops to that could be of use. But adding the diplomatic demand, okay, let's get a real status of forces agreement, that would be a very smart move on the part of Washington. Has there been any indication it's going to happen?
No, and of course, all indications are Washington hasn't been all that smart in its Iraq diplomacy. Yeah. And the other thing you have to keep in mind, that if Turks, the Kurds, the U.S. doesn't help out the Shia Iraqis, the Iranians will, one way or the other.
All right.
The last thing they want to see is another Sunni dictatorship running Iraq.
All right, Dan, one last little bit here on this, just so everybody, what you just heard with, you know, Jim and I usually go on these podcasts where, well, there's Jim's opinion, Austin, and we talk about it, but what we just did there when I came up and said, hey, let's think of some operations, that's some of the stuff that we used to do in the early days of Quick and Dirty Guide to War, even back in the 80s, sit there, and so you all got a little insight into, okay, what's the operation, what do we do, so anyway.
Right. Well, I'm sure we'll be talking about what's happening in Iraq over the next month or so. So we will talk to you all later. Thanks, and we'll see
you. Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.